Okay, so just a reminder that you should be getting together with your project groups and starting to make a plan, and then set up time to talk to me. So far, I've only had one request out of something like 7 or 8 groups. So put that on your agenda.
I hope we have the exam ready to hand back on Thursday, but I'm not sure about that because it depends a little on Mayor's midterm exam schedule. So can't ask her to spend a lot of time grading when she has her own exam she has to take this week. But I'm not sure what day she has it. Anyway, hopefully we'll get those back Thursday. If not, we'll be aiming for Tuesday. So last time, we looked at a number of things. We started out in direct current world and looked at an interesting situation where, actually, this isn't what we looked at. We looked at an interesting situation where you take a fully charged capacitor and basically discharge it through an inductor. And we set up the equation and looked at the energy flow, which I'm not going to repeat right now. And in fact, didn't mean for that to stay there. We found that when you looked at the energy flow, you ended up with a differential equation in the charge on the capacitor that is in simple harmonic form. So we can write down a solution of harmonic with frequency, harmonic in time, and this is some arbitrary phase angle from the initial situation. This would be the maximal charge on the capacitor, and Q is a function of time. Then actually with simple harmonic function, what it means, simple harmonic behavior, it means you start out with a total Q here, and basically it then bleeds off and comes over to the other side, etc. And you have Q on both sides, so both charges would basically just oscillate back and forth. So what that means is as they're moving, you end up with maximal current in the inductor. You can measure this is a charge take derivative of time, and what you find is also going to be harmonic, but it's going to be out of phase because you've taken the derivative. And it might make sense when the charge is all sitting on the C, if it's oscillating back and forth, at that moment you'll have no current. But then as it's flowing, you'll have maximal current in L. And of course, when you have maximal current in L, you get a maximal magnetic field in the inductor, which means you have most of the energy, or all the energy in the inductor in the magnetic field. When the charge is at its greatest here on the capacitor, you'll have all the energy in the electric field stored in the capacitor. So we end up with a situation, if we calculate the electric field and the magnetic field based on the charge and the current, which you should both know how to do, what you find is that you'll get also harmonic behavior, and then the energy density goes as E squared and B squared, so you end up with the sine and cosine squared terms for the energy in the electric field and the capacitor. Starts out maximal if you have the capacitor completely charged, and then it bleeds off, and at the time the current is maximal, you'll have all the energy maximal in the magnetic field, and it peaks. At that time, you basically have no charge left on the capacitor, so there's no electric field there, there's no energy there, and then the charge basically goes the other way. So that what you see is that you end up with this situation, and this is in a... By construction, we have no resistance on this, so there's no place for the energy to go other than back and forth. So we start out with a situation where we have a fully charged capacitor with all the energy in the electric field there, and then the charge begins to flow. As it flows, you have current. You begin to get a magnetic field. The electric field is reduced because the charge has begun to move. Reach a point where you have maximal current. You have maximum energy in the magnetic field. Nothing in the capacitor, so no electric field. And then basically the fields, your current continues to flow, and you'll have the field basically switching directions. So the field in the capacitor, for example, will oscillate. The magnetic field will also oscillate in direction. And this happens with the characteristic frequency of that harmonic,
the initial equation, which is this omega squared goes as 1 over LC.
So LC is what we call the frequent natural frequency for this circuit. Okay, so that's the frequency with which this energy oscillates back and forth. You okay with that? Okay, so this is an important step along the way. Of course, this is a little bit nonsense because anything has resistance in it. So we're going to begin to look at circuits that have L, R, and C. And Pat, in fact, we're going to do it in a more interesting situation than where it has AC. And but that said, a circuit will have a sort of a natural frequency which is sort of driven by this L and C. Okay, it may have a more complex behavior because you add in resistance or something, but there will be this LC, which you can always consider as a natural frequency for the circuit. Any questions about LC oscillations and what's going on there? So the next step is to, in fact, look at AC circuits and to look at things that we have when we add resistance into an LC. So I'd like to do that in an alternating current setting. So in an alternating current, you basically have EMF which varies sinusoidally. So it's all positive over here, all negative over here, and then that value falls and then flips sign in a sine wave. Okay, so that's characteristic for AC circuits, or what we mean by AC. And again, it makes sense to do that because that is a natural thing that you'll get if you basically take a current loop in a fixed magnetic field and rotate it. And if you look at the EMF and use that to generate the oscillation, you'll end up with a harmonic function. So it's physically reasonable to set it up, to make it physically. But when we do this, which again we did last time, so I'm going to try not to belabor it, we start out with the EMF, say, varying as a sine wave. And V is equal to IR, so if we look at the current, it should be proportional to what you have for the EMF. So they should be in phase because V goes as IR, so the EMF should go basically as the current. So if we were to plot the EMF, so this would be the natural EMF, this would be the voltage that's put across the resistor. What you find is the current through the resistor is proportional to that, and divided, you know, V is equal to IR, so V over R is the current. So there'll be, I mean, this is sort of two different units, so you have to be a little bit careful what you mean by the different scales here. But one important thing, you see that they're in phase. If we go to a capacitor, Q goes as CV, which means the Q will be in phase. The charge on the capacitor will be in phase with the EMF. But if we ask now what is the current in the capacitor, then we have to take the derivative of the charge on the capacitor as a function of time. And so that goes to cosine. And what that means is that if you look at the current on the capacitor, it's going to be out of phase with the EMF. So it's going to look like a cosine. So it looks something like this curve. And if you think about it, we now have this expression for I. And this is basically the EMF, this piece over here. Okay, the phase may differ, but it's more or less the EMF. So if we sort of think about the relationship V is equal to IR, then if we divide by this omega C, you more or less have this quantity, the 1 over omega C, plays a role of resistance in the AC circuit, and we call it the capacitive reactance, and it gets this weird symbol. Okay with that?
All right, so we have a similar thing with the inductor. The EMF goes as LDI dt.
So we can solve for, basically, you can now solve for I, and this time it goes again as the cosine, because you have this derivative difference between the EMF and the current. But now you have a minus sign that's in there. So again, it is out of phase. This would be the EMF. This would be the current in the inductor, and it's out of phase, but it's flipped in sign compared to what we saw across the capacitor.
All right, across the capacitor, it looks like a cosine, and across the inductor, it looks like a negative cosine. Okay?
And again, if you look at the fundamental relationship between the current and this thing, which more or less looks like the EMF, you get this proportionality constant, omega L, which can act like a resistance for the inductor in an AC circuit. So that we call it inductive reactance. Okay?
Okay, so now we have all the pieces, basically, to look at the more general case and look at the behavior of it. So I'd like to consider the case where we have an EMF across an inductor, across a resistor, and a capacitor. So because we're very creative in this business, we call it an LRC circuit. All right. And the EMF, again, is equal to E max times the sine of omega t.
So we have the sinusoidal dependence in there, and the solution of this is a bit nastier. So let me basically assume
that the current goes as I, some sort of maximal current, times a harmonic function. And then the question is, if you solve it this way, what you really want to do is try to figure out what those two things are.
Right, because whether it's in phase or out of phase, or a little bit in phase and a little bit out of phase, you can handle this five.
So I'm not going to do this one explicitly, but I want to discuss it a little bit.
So in this case, we have, and I'm not trying to get the relative magnitudes here, but in this case, we have the EMF as this dark blue line, and then if we think of the three individual pieces that we've had, that we just looked at earlier, we've got the resistor, which is this orange, which is going to be in phase, goes as a sine. Then we have the current that goes across the capacitor, which is this reddish stuff. So that goes as a cosine. Now it's out of phase. It peaks out of phase with the resistive current and the EMF.
But it goes as a cosine, and then across the inductor, we have something that goes as a cosine as well, but it's a minus cosine. So it
looks like this, but it's flipped and signed. So it's a complicated situation, and if you want to look at this, trying to solve it now, as you go across the elements, you have to look at the EMF that goes across the resistor, which goes as IR. R is equal to V. V is equal to IR. So if we're looking at IR here, I is in phase times R, so the resistor. And then if we look at the voltage drop across the capacitor, right, it will also go as IR, but now the R we're using is this capacitive reactance. Okay. And the same is true for the inductor, except it's the inductive reactance, and you have this flip and sign. If you have these other pieces in there, you have to have the relative sign. Okay, so I'm not going to solve that for you. There is a way to look at this, which you'll often see where people use sort of a graphical analysis of the current and the EMF vectors rotating in the plane. Ohanian actually talks about it, and you're welcome to look through it. I have to make choices as to how deep to go into certain subjects, and this is about as far as I want to go into AC. You don't know enough to wire your own house, so don't try. I wouldn't try. At any rate, so there is, this can be analyzed. You're welcome to figure it out. I think some earlier edition of Ohanian also did a nice derivation of this using sort of math and trig IVs. It's not really worth our time to dig through that solution. Depending on what you decide to do, you may choose to do that and think it's important. But I do want to look at what comes out of it. So when you look at this analysis, what you find is that you can solve for the phase angle in this thing, the tangent of the phase angle turns out to be equal to the difference between the inductive and capacitive reactances divided by the resistance, and the current, the maximum current, is equal to the maximal EMF, and then you might think it's divided by some sort of resistive reactance sort of thing, because V is equal to IR. So you want to put some sort of R-like thing down here, and it turns out that the form you end up with has contributions from the resistance in the resistor as well as the resistance across the inductor and the capacitor. And it takes this form. So this is what plays the role of resistance in an LRC circuit. So this would be sort of more general than the kind of stuff we've already looked at, because any real circuit is going to have an L and an R and a C, right? Now maybe one of them is small enough you can sort of ignore it, but you have to worry about it. And in the spirit of maintaining job security, it's very important that we make up a cool word for this. But for a cool word, it needs a cool color. So this thing is what we call the impedance. And we give it a symbol Z, not to be confused with the gauge boson.
maybe that's only a problem for me, but if you're into particle physics, impedance is not the same thing as the sequence. So we have this cool combination. Now, what's really fun about this is what happens if we vary the some of these quantities. So, remember that we have this frequency in the EMF. So that's sort of this driving voltage in the circuit. And note that this impedance goes as R squared plus, Let's look at what happens if the frequency approaches what I'll call the natural frequency of the circuit, which is this 1 over LC. Just to remind you, way back when we looked at a DC circuit, if we just had the inductor and the capacitor in there and we looked at the frequency of the LC oscillations, that frequency goes as this square root of 1 over LC. So now what I want to look at is I want to look at the impedance in this LRC circuit when the frequency approaches what I'll call the natural frequency of this circuit. And why I call it that, we'll see in a second. So there's, just to remind you, sorry for all this movement around. Chi sub L goes as omega L, and chi sub C goes as 1 over omega C. And you'll note that my L's and my C's look deceptively similar to each other, and that's just to keep you on your toes. So this goes as 1 over LC. So if we now take an expression for the impedance, and we substitute in here for what we would get if omega was equal to this omega zero, then this would end up as omega L times 1 over LC, and this omega goes as, what am I doing wrong? As the square root of 1 over the square root of LC, sorry. And I'm dropping something. Oh, it's not 1 over LC, it's 1 over omega C. Make sure I wrote it correctly up above. Yeah, 1 over omega C. Okay. So this term becomes L over the square root of LC, and this term becomes square root of LC over C. So this becomes square root of L over C. This becomes square root of L over C. So what that means is that this term goes to zero as omega goes to omega zero. Okay? The reason you care is because if this term goes to zero, you're basically minimizing this resistive term.
You're not killing it because you have resistance in the circuit, which is this R, but you're minimizing it. It means that you are creating a situation where the inductor and the capacitor are not contributing to this overall impedance or resistance in the AC circuit. So if you minimize this resistance piece, you are maximizing the current that you can have. Okay? So you can now imagine building a device where you either change the frequency of the voltage or you're changing the capacitance or the inductance inside the circuit. So you can make a device that has an adjustable inductance or an adjustable capacitance, for example, and you change it, and whenever the natural frequency, this 1 over the square root of LC, happens to hit the frequency that you're using to drive at this EMF, you'll get a spike in the current. So this is how you build a radio tuner. Right? So now all of a sudden you've got enough power to play and do some cool things. So you may be sitting there wondering if indeed I'm just full of shit, that I might be just lying to you because it's fun. I shall show you. In fact, this actually happens. So we have a resistor, an inductor, and a capacitor. And right now I have a full LRC on there. And what you see here, this curve would be, let me make sure it is, so this one represents the voltage. The voltage is functional, it doesn't get moved. It represents the voltage that is being put across the LRMC. Alright? And then what we have here should be across the resistor, I believe. It's basically a measure of current in the circuit. So now, if I vary, for example, the inductor, the current in the circuit drops as I vary it. It will peak and then start to go back down. So what happens is as I approach the natural frequency of this circuit by adjusting this LR, by adjusting the L, I will minimize that one term, and when I do, basically the current will peak. And then it will go back down when I move away from it. So it's a resonance that you get in your circuit. So if we were to plot the current as a function of the frequency,
and we look at omega zero, you'll end up with something that looks a little more symmetric than that. But basically you get this nice peak, so you get a very nice resonance. So if you hear people talking about electronic circuits and using lots of mechanical terms like resonance and tuning the circuit, things like that, this is the kind of game that they're able to crack. Yes?
In the formula for impedance, should it be XL minus XC plus rho plus?
Probably. Yeah. Thank you. That helps the term go away. That's good. Yep. Plus, minus. You know, in physics, often you're just looking for the gist of it. They both involve straight lines. It's close enough. Anyway, so speaking of which, this is sort of about all the gist of AC I wanted to do. To get you sort of to see something cool like this. But I don't really want to belabor it too much. So, any questions? Okay. Now you've heard the word impedance. I think I heard that word for a very long time before I had any idea what it actually meant. People talk about impedance matching and things like this. So, anyway. So what I'd like to do next is to think about magnetic fields and matter. We talked about electric fields and matter, so let's do electric fields and matter. Magnetic fields and matter. Wow. What did I just say? Talk about electric fields and matter. So now what I'd like to do is to talk about magnetic fields and matter. And you may remember that when we did electric fields and matter, things got fairly interesting. With magnetic fields, I think it's even more so, because matter has sort of, instead of sort of two ways of looking at it, there's three. So, a way to think about how magnetism interacts in matter is to think about the fact that atoms are made up of particles, some of which have inherent what we call spin. So the electron has an inherent spin. What does that really mean? What it means is if I were to take an electron and put it through trying to figure out how far down this road I want to get, or whether I've just jumped off a slippery slope of which there may be no recovery very easily. Let me back up a little bit. Let's imagine that in an atom we have electrons, and in the Bohr model you have electrons moving around in a little loop. Okay? If you think of that as a current loop, it's going to have a magnetic field. Okay? So you might imagine that atoms could have a magnetic field that you would get from the fact that this electron goes in a current loop. It is more complicated than that, so I'm going to try not to jump off a cliff and end up wasting a half an hour talking about a lot of other things. You've probably heard about some of these other things. Certainly if you've had chemistry or you've done some modern physics, and I actually don't know if Joe Eppley does anything with shell structure of atoms in 143, does he? Really? I am going to give him enormous crap about that. It's actually pretty important stuff. But if you've had general chemistry, you've actually seen it. But when you solve Schrodinger's equation for the
if you think of the electron as a wave, and you solve for the solutions that you can have for the wave and a spherically symmetric Coulomb potential, all right, what you get are a lot of stable states. But they have interesting geometries and different energies. And what you find is because electrons are so-called fermions, what I mean by that I'll say in a second, that they'll come in pairs. So very often you'll have... I'll have to back up and get, go to it. So what we find is that if you just have an atom and you look at the solutions of it and you have an electron in a spherically symmetric state, then you might expect to see no magnetic... It has no orbital angular momentum, so you'd expect to see no magnetic moment. And you can arrange for beams of atoms that basically are in such a state, and when you send them through a non-uniform magnetic field, a non-uniform magnetic field will take a particle that has a net magnetic moment, and it'll actually exert a non-uniform force. It'll exert a force on it. So what you find is if you had a beam of particles that had net magnetic fields, they would sort of split as they go through this magnetic field region. It's called the Stern-Gerlach device or experiment. What people found, which was very surprising, was at some point they had arranged a situation where they had atoms with no angular momentum, and they sent them through this Stern-Gerlach apparatus, and in fact they found they split into two pieces. And the only way they could interpret that was that there was somehow the electron in the atom had an inherent magnetic moment. So it's a very bizarre thing that not only do you potentially have angular momentum for the electron in its movement around the nucleus, if you want to think of it that way, which is one of the, you get solutions in the Schrodinger's equation, and many of them have net angular momentum. If you have net angular momentum, you can think of it as charge spinning around this atom and has magnetic moment that corresponds to it. With magnetic moment, I mean, it's like a current loop and you have a net magnetic field. In addition to that, because of the Stern-Gerlach experiment, where people had the atom arranged in a non-angular momentum state and found that it actually split anyway, they discovered that they only could explain that by assuming that the particle, the electron, has an inherent magnetic moment. You can imagine an electron, if you were to think of it as a little spherical charge distribution, of which we have absolutely not one iota of evidence that that's true. Right? There's no evidence of any substructure for the electron whatsoever, so it may sound sort of crazy to now think of it as this charge distribution, but if it were a charge distribution, you could have a magnetic field inherent to it if that charge distribution spun. So people talk about having discovered the electron's spin. So what they saw in the Stern-Gerlach experiment was consistent with the electron having a spin like this or a spin like that. And in certain units, you would say that spin is quantized in units of 1/2, which basically means in quantum mechanics it can be oriented one way or the other way. And so particles that have half integral spin like that are called fermions, and those that have zero or integral spin, which in quantum mechanics means you can have three orientations, are called bosons. And why did I start talking about that? The reason is if you start to look at matter, then how matter interacts in a magnetic field will depend on whether it has an inherent magnetic moment. If it looks at some level like a bar magnet itself, and that magnetic moment could be something you think of as the spin of some of the particles, the nucleus or the electron or whatever, or it could be the magnetic moment of the atoms themselves, which can come from the unpaired spins of the electrons in the orbital shells. So imagine if I have an atom where I have 5 or 6 electrons that have unpaired spins, then that atom as a whole is going to have It would be like a bar magnet made up of five little bar magnets. So we'll have a large magnetic moment. Okay, so iron turns out to be a nucleus that is similar to this. So the more that you have a piece of matter that acts like an individual bar magnet, then the more you might affect, you might imagine it's affected by an external magnetic field. Okay, so that's sort of the gist of it. So what I want to do is talk for a moment about current loops and magnetic fields, because that's the model that we use for magnetic moments and how they should act in a magnetic field. I might have done better with that had I actually thought I was going to jump off that cliff earlier. But sometimes you just find yourself up there talking about something and realize, oh, it's too late. I blew that. So sorry if that was not too coherent. But let's imagine that I have a Cartesian coordinate system. And let's have a uniform magnetic field oriented in the positive y direction. And I would like to create a current loop such that the analysis of it isn't crazy. So I want to create sort of a rectangular current loop. And I'm going to make a vector that comes, okay, so this rectangular current loop is free to rotate about the z-axis. And let's say that it's bisected sort of by the origin. So this distance I'll call 1/2 L prime, and this distance is sort of 1/2 L prime. So L prime is the total distance on that side, and I'll call this distance L. And again, half of it is to one side of the origin, half to the other. And let's imagine that I have a current in this thing that's going around the loop like so. So if we were to put an eyeball here so that the z-axis basically comes right into the eyeball and look at it, then we would see something that looks like this. We would have the current coming out at us and the current going in, and then you would see the this piece would basically be that bar that you would see with your eye. And let's say that this loop has a vector that is normal to it, and we'll call this angle theta. So what I'd like to do is to look at the net force that's on this current loop, the net torque on the current loop, due to the magnetic field. So in order to think about torque, you want to think about the force that's on each of these sides of the magnetic current loop. If we look at this piece, we have, remember it's IL cross P. So we would have I along the Z, okay, curled into P. So it's going to basically go into the board in the negative X direction.
So we're going to have a force that goes like that. And that force will be equal to I times our L times B. If we look down here, the current is going in, velocity is going to be going out in the positive X direction, same magnitude. If we look at this piece, it's going to have a force. The I is down, crosses into B. It's basically going to go out in Z. And if you look at this other piece, it's going to go negative in Z. So you will have no part of the force on those two elements that contributes to the torque of the rotation about Z. So if we think of this distance as the lever arm for one of the forces, that's going to be, if that's theta, then by geometry this is theta. So this distance is going to be 1/2 times the L prime times the sine of theta. Because this piece or that piece has a length of 1/2 L prime. So the torque is going to be 2, because I have a force here and a force here that are identical in magnitude. It'll be 2 times the force times that lever arm. That'll be the torque kind of rotated about Z. Force is ILB. L times L prime is just A. That's the area of this loop. So what I want to do is to define a vector. So that's the magnitude of the torque. What I'd like to do is to define a vector, which is mu, which is equal to I times A, basically times this in half. Okay, so this normal to this loop, where the magnitude of mu is equal to I times A. But if I define it as normal to this thing, then I get the equation, because this would then be mu sine theta times B, so it would be, and mu, the normal to this thing, this would be the direction of mu. And it would make an angle of, it would make an angle of theta with the magnetic field. So this is just mu cross B. Sort of painful, but you okay with that? So if I have a current loop in a magnetic field, there is a torque that is mu cross B, which is trying to rotate the magnetic moment into the field. Or a way to think about it is, if it's a little bar magnet and I have a field oriented this way, the bar magnet wants to rotate into the field. Okay? So let's think about matter. And it turns out that we can think about matter of three different types. Let's imagine that we have some material. That's made up, it has sort of natural dipoles. So this might be, you know, a material where you have some unpaired electrons, or it could be an atom that has a non-zero angular momentum, so that it has sort of a natural. You can think of the material as being made up of natural little bar magnets. Generally speaking, they'll be randomly oriented because you have a lot of thermal things moving stuff around. So now if we take this material, and we put it in an external magnetic field, and what's going to happen is there will now be a net torque on all of these little magnetic moments trying to align them. And so if you do that, then in fact you will align some of these things. The alignment will not be perfect because as they align, you'll still have thermal motion and things that move them around inside the material. So if I'm aligning these little magnetic moments with the field, then inside the material, I have the external B field superimposed with the little aligned field that you're getting from all these little bits of magnet, or bar magnets, you can think of them that way. So in this case, the magnetic field is going to be increased. And you might imagine, very similar to what we did with external electric fields and materials, where you have dipoles that would align in the electric field. Here you have magnetic dipoles aligning in the magnetic field. As you increase B, you might expect that you'll get more and more of these things aligning. And as a first, the first thing you would try is say, well, maybe that's linear. Okay, the stronger B is, the more of these things I get aligned, which means the magnetic field in the material grows linearly with the external field. And you could imagine now putting a proportionality constant in front of that, because different materials will have sort of a different increase in that field as you increase it. So you can probably see that car coming at you. So materials that exhibit this, we call paramagnetic materials. So just like we had with electrical things, the electric field, sometimes you'll have materials that are made up of things that have no unpaired spins, or they have no net angular momentum, so there is no inherent magnetic dipole in this thing. So now you take this material and you immerse it in a magnetic field, and
I'm going to paint an intuitive picture, which is not going to be accurate, but I think we have to do some quantum mechanics to be more accurate. Imagine that I have current loops without current in them, and I now introduce a magnetic field. Then you can imagine that that will now induce a current which is aiming to fight that magnetic field. So in that picture, you could imagine as I introduce this magnetic field, it will induce little magnetic dipoles. Again, not perfectly, but they are going to oppose me. And in these materials, then, you'll find that B is weakened, oddly enough. Usually the degree of weakening is small compared to the degree of strengthening you can get with paramagnetic materials, but you can do it. The weakness in my intuitive argument there is that if B is steady, you'll still have a weaker B in the material. So it's as if the induced dipoles stay there, which classically we don't do. But the intuition, I hope, will help a little bit. So materials that do this are called paramagnetic materials. No, I'm sorry. Diamagnetic. What am I thinking? We already did para. Diamagnetic materials. Okay. And then there is a third category, which are called ferromagnetic materials. And these materials, of which iron is the classic example, they have so many unpaired electrons that their inherent magnetic moment is strong enough that they have a very strong interaction locally. So what happens with these materials is that they have strong inherent dipoles, so you have the material in here, and you'll end up having sort of local domains where you have a fairly strong orientation. So what happens now if you put in an electric magnetic field is that you will begin to get some of these domains to line up, but not all of them. But as you increase the magnetic field, you'll get more and more of them to line up. And here, the alignment is much stronger than you have in paramagnetic materials, where you have the coupling to all the little local dipoles really isn't as strong, so you have a lot more thermal juggling, and you can think of them as being largely independent. In a paramagnetic material, they are locally not independent, and you have a pretty strong local field with these domains. Okay? And then what you're doing by applying the external field is you're actually beginning to shift some of these domains. They will change, sort of like you have in paramagnetism, but sort of the domain will go. And so what you're doing is you're sort of increasing the fraction of the material that basically belongs to a domain with an alignment along the field. The thing that is very interesting here is that if you remove the magnetic field from the paramagnetic materials, they thermally just become unaligned. If you remove the magnetic field from the iron, some of the domains will get misaligned. It will depend a little on the temperature and stuff, but a lot of them will stay just like they are. So you have basically a permanent magnet. So because you have a lot of alignment here, you will get, again, the B is increased. Any questions on sort of conceptually what's happening? Yeah. Yeah, you'll get a reduction in the. You can weaken the magnetism in a permanent magnet if you heat it up. If you heat it enough and then cool it down, you'll probably just end up with random alignments. And if you melt it down in quart, you're going to end up with just random alignments in the iron. So it'll be sort of like. And so you may have a little bit of a net magnetic field in it, just because you'll naturally have something starts out crystallizing first or something, maybe some alignment will begin. You'll have a little bit of dominance, but you'll have a lot of domains where the alignment isn't right or it's even backwards. So it would weaken. So we'll come back to iron in a minute. But one of the things you'll notice in these is that you have a characteristic that's not so different from what we saw with what happens with electrical fields. Although with electrical field, generally you were reducing the magnitude of the field in a diamagnetic material. Here, you can increase or weaken the field depending on whether it's paramagnetic or diamagnetic, or you can get a pretty strong enhancement of the field if it's ferromagnetic. But in all cases, the magnitude of the effect, you would imagine, is going to depend to a large extent on the size of the external field. So we can try to quantify that. And you can imagine not only will it depend on the size of the field, it's definitely going to depend on the material itself. So just like we have with different dielectric materials, they all have different dielectric constants. Here you're going to have dielectric constants that depend on the material. So to try to quantify this, we say that the magnetic field in the material is equal to mu zero, which would be the permeability of free space, times 1 plus chi m times the magnetic field external. Often, this external field people call the free field. And magnetism is simply not going to be outdone by electricity. So as in electricity, we have dielectric constants, and then we have permittivity, right? Not just permittivity of free space, but permittivity. Here, we're going to have this quantity chi sub m, which is called the magnetic susceptibility. So you can imagine having a table of magnetic susceptibilities. Note that we both can strengthen and weaken the field in a material. So unlike what you have with the dielectric constants, which always have one algebraic sign,
here, the magnetic susceptibility could have positive or negative charge. The paramagnetic material is going to be positive. If it's ferromagnetic, it's going to be big and positive. And if it's diamagnetic, it's going to be a little, it's going to be negative, but not hugely negative. Okay. So that would be the magnetic susceptibility. This we call the relative permeability. Which has a symbol case of M. All right. Running out of colors. This which is, of course, mu0km, we define as the permeability of the material, which just has the symbol mu. So it's even better than electrical. I could give you a table of any of the three of these. Isn't that wonderful? That's what I like about physics. It's very rich. I mean, just think how boring English is. You have a book, and each word supposedly means, I mean, I guess that's true. Words can mean different things. Never mind. I shouldn't bash on them. So this is our version of literary richness. Okay? Tell that to your English major friends. Yeah?
You said the temperature can affect the view of material too. Could that be like a different equation or a different term? Like,
Yeah, probably these would have to be tables given to you at specific temperatures. In the electrical system with the dielectric, if you have a linear dielectric, the more you increase the electric field, the more polarization you get, and the more you're decreasing the field inside the material. For an actual real dielectric, that probably breaks down when the field is strong enough that you start to rip apart things. Okay, so you get breakdown going through the material. You ionize things and you get, it's probably not pretty. But the extreme case is if you have a conductor where things are free to move. And there you know what happens is you basically go until you get zero field inside the conductor. So that's sort of the extreme case. So in a sense, you have a natural saturation of the degree to which the electric field can do this. Here we have sort of a similar thing in that this linear regime works where the fields are fairly small and you have dipoles that you can orient. Right? Then the stronger the field is, the more these dipoles you orient. But once you've got them all oriented, you can't do any more with it. You have as strong a field as you're going to get in the material. So this is particularly interesting to talk about with paramagnetic materials because of the fact that when you orient things, you can then remove the external field and it stays, which is very different from anything we've done with dielectrics, and it is different from diamagnetic materials or paramagnetic materials, where if I remove the magnetic field external, it goes back to the way it was. Okay? So with iron materials, you sort of have an interesting behavior. Here's the magnetic field in the iron. And here's the magnetic field, which is the external, or the free magnetic field. You can imagine you start out with zero. Let's say you have completely unaligned domains and you have an external field. Now, as you add in a stronger field, you'll get a big change, which will sort of grow, and then it will begin to saturate off because you've got them all aligned. So as the free field gets stronger, you get a very strong internal field as you align more and more of these dipoles, domains, but then you reach a point of diminishing returns because you've aligned everything, so you won't get any more change. So let us imagine now that we now reduce the strength of the external field and look at what happens inside the iron. As you reduce the strength of the external field, many of the domains will stay aligned, but some of them will thermally come out of alignment. So the field externally will begin to drop, but not as fast as it was increasing. And it will continue to drop, and as you now reduce the external field to zero, you actually have a fixed magnetic field in the iron that stays there, even though the external field is now zero. So now, if you flip the external field, you end up with something like this, and then you can do the reverse process, and you end up something like that. And this whole thing is called a hysteresis loop. And you may ask, why do you really care? Well, why you care is that for a relatively small external field, which I can't remember exactly what it is, you can get a strength of about 2 tesla inside the iron. So you can actually get, you can have a current loop that generates this external field, and then you get a huge gain. It's greatly magnified by the iron itself, because as you go up in the field, you get this strong alignment, and you get a very strong magnetic field. So electromagnets are used for a reason, and this is why you sort of get a lot of electromagnetic field for free. Then, as you remove this magnetic field, the problem is you're not absolutely sure what the magnetic field is in the iron, because it changes, but it changes in a way that's a little bit hard to know. If you take the iron and you don't fully saturate it, then you're not sure where you are. When you remove the magnetic field, you're not really sure what the field is. So if you have a really precision magnetic instrument, what you want to do is to actually go through the hysteresis loop so that you know exactly what the field is. So very often, if you have some electromagnet you're using for a piece of lab stuff, or a magnet in, you know, an accelerator or an NMR or something like that, then you want to actually have this external field, increase it, and go around this hysteresis loop so that you know exactly what your magnetic field is. And I need to stop there because the boards are anxious to get to physics 113. So thanks.
system of energy. If magnetic fields have inherent energy, what sort of work?
Well, it takes energy to get things along, so you do have to have an external field that does that. And then you may remove that, so I guess you could say stores energy in the room. So it's a little bit like you charge up a capacitor and then you can move and you still have to pass the charge.
So does it take energy from the original field in any way then?
Yes, it must.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I would have to, I guess. And you're aligning these currently. If you don't see a change,
he's right there.
Thank you.
Okay, so
let's,
how many of you are?
Eight.
Okay. Why don't you meet me in the lobby of Kaushin? What I'll do is I'll go and see if I can grab one of the meetings and have a good time.